58 now, Linda. Any final thoughts before we move to our next program?
I will. Thank you very much for reminding me of where we are. So there is the Oregon Workers Relief Fund. I want to leave you with that. That is a way to aid your fellow workers. That's direct aid. It's a mutual aid organization that's been brought up to here in Oregon to help fund workers. So it's the Oregon Workers Relief Fund, and I'll leave you with that to help your neighbors and the people who bring the food to the table. And I just want to say thank you to all of you out there, our listeners to KBOO. You make a huge difference to us. It's why the station exists. It's a membership-run, volunteer-driven, and with a great little bit of staff. So I want to thank all of you for that. And thank you for tuning in today to KBOO. Thank you, Celeste, for being our engineer today, as well as our co-manager.
You are very welcome. Thank you all to our KBOO family.
Talking about a revolution that sounds like a whisper. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution that sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know they're talking about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metropolitan area, 91.9 in Hood River, Oregon, Whitesville, Washington, 104.3 in Philomath and Port South. And now we are joined with Teresa in Press Watch. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you so much. Well, today I'm very pleased that Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD, founder of Recombinomics Incorporated, has once again agreed to a live interview on KBOO. He's an internationally renowned virologist hard at work on analyzing the insanely devious ways, means, and construction of the disease that has stunned the world. And when he appeared on Press Watch in January and February, his work accurately predicted the disaster we now face. So now we can turn to him again for further analysis. And if the phone lines are working correctly and everything's all set up, then Dr. Nyman, thank you so much for taking the time away from your essential work to be on the air here again.
Dr. Nyman will be with us shortly.
Okay. Well, Dr. Nyman is actively researching the coronavirus, and he has agreed to be with us. And while he's doing that, I want to let you know that the president has put cronyism ahead of science, and Dr. Rick Bright has been fired because he dared to cross Donald Trump over Trump's quack cure chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine. And there's an article in commondreams.org about that topic. It's by Jake Johnson. And he writes, a high-ranking federal scientist and one of the leading vaccine experts in the U.S. said in a withering statement on Wednesday that he was fired from his post as director of the Department of Health and Human Services Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority because he questioned and resisted President Donald Trump's promotion of untested COVID-19 treatments, particularly hydroxychloroquine. And he writes, Dr. Rick Bright, who was moved to a post at the National Institutes of Health, that he believes the transfer was in response, this is a quote, to my insistence that the government invest the billions of dollars allocated by Congress to address the COVID-19 pandemic into safe and scientifically vetted solutions and not in drugs, vaccines, and other technologies that lack scientific merit. And he said, I also resisted efforts to fund potentially dangerous drugs promoted by those with political connections specifically, and contrary to misguided directives, I limited the broad use of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine promoted by the administration as a panacea, but which clearly lack scientific merit, end quote. And so Bright is obviously taking Trump head on, since Trump has been running his daily circus show about what he hasn't done about COVID-19 every day.
And we are joined now with Dr. Nyman, Teresa.
All right. Dr. Nyman, thank you so much for joining us once again. So you've been actively researching the coronavirus, and what aspect of the virus are you working on currently?
I'm mostly looking at how it's evolving and what versions are circulating where, and trying to get a better idea on not only what's going on, but what's coming. So,
well, what you said the last couple of times I had you on in January and February was very prescient, and we're all now in that reality that you predicted. What characteristic of the virus is standing out to you in your research right now?
Well, one of the unusual aspects is the clotting issues and this high level of clots that are found in patients seems to be contributing to strokes and heart attacks, probably creating a significant undercount where strokes and heart attack victims are not being counted fully because some are dying at home and not tested subsequently. And exactly what that is due to is still a little bit unclear, but it might be related to the response of the host to the virus, and it might have a higher incidence than expected in younger people that get into those types of problems because they have a fairly vigorous response. It's got some parallels with the 1918 pandemic where younger people were dying from cytokine storms, which were again tied to their immune response to the virus. And one of the genetic aspects of this virus, which is probably contributing to the clinical picture, is its cleavage site. It has a polybasic cleavage site, which is somewhat analogous to high path avian influenza, where they have a number of basic amino acids at the cleavage site. And that allows them to enter different cell types because they rely upon the protease by the cell type to actually do that cleavage. And for the SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19, it has three basic amino acids at the cleavage site instead of the normal one, and that allows a protease called furin, F-U-R-I-N, to cleave it. And furin is present in a lot of different cell types, and it's at relatively high levels in many different cell types, and that's probably contributing to the virus's ability to attack various cells that aren't necessarily in the respiratory tract and cause problems in other organs. And it could be that ability to travel more widely in the post-anatomy that may be producing these responses that are creating all kind of additional complications.
Just before you came on, I was characterizing your work as analyzing the insanely devious ways, means, and construction of this disease. Do you find that this virus is particularly odd?
Yeah, I mean, I don't usually do that much on the clinical side, but it does seem to be causing a lot of different problems that aren't normally seen. I'm getting this from clinicians who are commenting on the problems that it's causing, and I am familiar with the Cleaver site and avian influenza and why it's more pathogenic in at least its avian hosts and the ability of the virus to go to several different organs and it really sounds a lot of similarities with this particular virus. So this virus does seem to be causing a lot more problems than would be normally found in a respiratory virus. And just the histories of pandemics, raises concerns that it might be even worse in the fall. So that's to be seen, but it would not be a surprise. And would be kind of consistent with what happened with the H1N1 in the 1918 pandemic, as well as the swine version of H1N1 in the 2009 pandemic. And in both instances, the fall outbreaks were significantly more severe and widespread than the initial spring outbreak.
When you say fallout rates, I'm unfamiliar with that. Can you explain that?
Yeah, in both instances, the virus first appeared in the springtime, and it really wasn't that virulent when it first showed up. It was a novel virus that hadn't been in humans before, or at least that version hadn't, and so it was noticed. Actually, for 1918, it was barely noticed. It didn't really seem all that unusual. Of course, in 1918, they didn't have any sequences, and they didn't even know what influenza looked like. But they hardly noticed that the virus was present in the spring of 1918. But then in the fall of 1918, it kind of went down over the summer, and then came back with a vengeance in the fall. And the swine flu did the same thing. If you recall, in 2009, it was circulating in the spring and kind of outlasted the seasonal H1N1 and the seasonal H3N2. And by April or so, it was really the only influenza that was circulating. And then it outcompeted both of those. And so in the fall, it actually started like in August in the South when school started. Then it started to come back and become more prevalent. And the other two viruses weren't around at all. So the only flu that was circulating in the fall of 2009 was the swine flu. And at least here in Pittsburgh, it kind of initially just caused people to cough, and they really didn't have high fevers, and they were kind of going to school and kind of ignoring it. And then about 6 weeks later, it was much more virulent, and people had fevers, and absenteeism from school was 10 to 15%, both for teachers and students. And It didn't turn out to be that lethal. It did target younger people, but it was significantly more active in the fall than it was in the spring. So that happened in 1918 as well as 2009. And COVID, although it's not an influenza virus, it's more of a cold virus, but there's usually some seasonality, and that seasonality is is probably due to the length of the day and the sunlight. The viruses actually don't do that well in sunlight. And so in the summer, when the days are longer, and the for the northern hemisphere anyway, it's more direct overhead, so it inactivates the virus more easily, and people are outside more, instead of inside. And so these respiratory diseases tend to be somewhat seasonal. Now, the COVID isn't really showing a whole lot of evidence for a dramatic decline that the social distancing has kind of flattened the curve, so to speak. And places like New York, not only has it been flattened, it's starting to decline now. So it is going down somewhat in some of the major cities that had the larger outbreaks. But it's really hanging around in a lot of other places and expanding in other places. So it's even in New York, hospital admissions, when it peaked, got up to around 3,000 a day, and now it's down to about 1,300, but it seems to have leveled off, at least in the last few days, at around 1,300. So it's still a high rate of new infections in New York, even though it's markedly lower than the peak. And there are other locations where the numbers are still going up. And so it's getting towards May, and, flu is already pretty much faded away. So, and it follows a more traditional kind of seasonal, and usually by April, end of April, it's pretty much gone, and COVID is not gone. And because it's so widespread and it's at high levels in the U.S., obviously it's the highest level in the world, is probably going to hang around over the summer. It might go down a little bit, but it's not going to disappear. And that raises concerns that in the fall, it'll become more active. It'll have an ability to select a version that might escape immunity. The immunity, the numbers that are infected are fairly high. I don't know if you heard of Cuomo just gave a press conference. Actually, he's still giving it, but he gave the initial results on antibody studies in New York, and it does indicate that the level is high, and there's variation. Upstate is not that high, but it's relatively high even there. It's like 3.6%.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that.
Yeah,
so we have this new information that it's infecting more people, and also. I guess you recall that in case of the Chinese infections, it came out that they were handing out a great many more funeral urns than they claimed had died. And so does the new information both ways, does that affect the R-naught estimate, the estimate of how many people are infected, how contagious it is? I mean, what's that number estimated to be now?
I don't even know. I mean, I've seen it as high as 6. Most people say it's closer to 2 or 3, but that's not really taking into account the large number of asymptomatic cases. And so these numbers, the antibody levels in New York, the city, and Long Island, New York City is 21%, Long Island 16.7%. So it's a pretty significant percentage of the population. So the number of cases is 10 to 20 to 30 times what confirmed cases are. And so if you consider that these silent cases are really there, and you can kind of see it with the antibody, that if you got 10 times as many cases, the R-naught's going to be significantly higher. And I haven't seen the latest taking these numbers, and I mean, he just announced these a few minutes ago. And the numbers in California were closer to 2 to 4% of the population. So that was both in I think LA as well as up in the Bay Area. And these numbers for New York are really, you know, almost 10 times that. And
I can see how that would really throw the estimates off.
Right, right. So it seems to be, you know, higher, you know, significantly higher than flu. And and so that's why it's going to be very hard to control. And and with these numbers this high, and like I said, even in New York, it seems to be leveling off now with hospital admissions, at least in the recent past. It's like it's going to stay at this level, maybe not at the peak level, but at a level high enough that it's not going to disappear in the fall. It's going to come back stronger in the fall. And whether that's enough, in New York is probably enough for some selection, so that you know, that'll put pressure on coming up with a version that really can escape the existing immunity, and therefore almost everybody might be susceptible to a new version that pops up in the fall. That a little bit of selection pressure goes a long way towards creating a variant that's pretty dominant and pretty common, and that's already happening. The version that was in Italy pretty much is what's causing the outbreaks in the U.S. and the Northeast, and all up and down the coast, actually. So, mostly
that's traced by its chemical signature.
Yeah, it's got like four different changes in the four different positions are changed in the one of the two versions that showed up in northern Italy, and that version. Sometimes it's called the G-clad. It's the vast majority of the cases in New York and Massachusetts and Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, all along the Northeast. It's over 90% of the cases are that particular strain, and it's spreading out. It's showing up in the Midwest now, and it's kind of moving into the Northwest in the Seattle area, which used to be a different clade, an S clade was dominant there, and now this new one is kind of, I call it the Italian strain, because that's where it showed up in force and kind of spread out in Europe. Unfortunately, I'm sorry,
it certainly was vicious there.
Yeah, and it spread out to Africa and South America and then Russia, and it's you know, well beyond just Europe now, and it's all over the U.S. now. So it's becoming dominant, and it seems to have a bit of an advantage. And so even in areas like Seattle, which was a different clade, and it was almost exclusively that clade. If you look at the recent sequences in the last several weeks, you can see this Italian strain coming in there and becoming more common. And it's in other areas, like it's in Iowa, it's in Nebraska, it's in Arizona. So I mean, it's not just in the Northeast anymore. And it does seem to be a little bit more vicious. And and of course, you know, New York has, you know, easily the highest level based upon cases, and now these antibody studies are indicating it's got the highest frequency. I mean, some of the populations, African Americans and Hispanics, they're finding it's at 22% in those two groups. It's
Dr. Nyman and Teresa. We have a caller who called in who wanted some clarification about whether there are different strains, if they've been identified. So could you help us out with that information?
Well,
yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I just want to say you're listening to KBOO Portland. This show is called Press Watch, and you're listening to Henry L. Nyman, PhD, president and founder of Recombinomics, internationally known virologist researcher. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, as far as the strains are concerned, there's, yeah, you have the basic strain that showed up in Wuhan. So that's kind of the original index strain. And then there have been really three different strains that have anywhere from 2 to 4 changes. And those have been dominant. One of them I used to call ORF8 because it had one of the two mutations it had was in the ORF8 gene. The other one was in the ORF1A. So it had those two changes. And then, like I said, the Italian strain had like 4 different changes at 4 different positions. And then there's another one that initially was in Italy, but then showed up in Iran, and that had 2 different changes. And so the virus has 30,000, you know, different positions. That's how big it is. And so these are a relatively small number of changes, but the same changes show up in each of these 3 different lineages. And then over time, they tack on additional ones. So the more recent ones would have, you know, the Italian strain would have the 4 basic ones, and then they might have 3 or 4 or 5 additional changes. So over the index change, that they've got 6 or 7 changes now. And like I said, when they get to more pressure for selection, right now there's not that much selection pressure because the whole population is naive and hasn't really been exposed to the virus before. So the virus can basically attack most of the population. When some of the population has immunity, then that'll put selection pressure for a variant that can avoid that immunity. And then if it becomes widespread enough in the population, the other ones will kind of fade away because the target population has immunity, and then if one can evade that'll become dominant. And that's part of the reason the fall outbreaks frequently are more virulent than the spring, because spring anything will work, and it might not work to that high a level because it's adjusting.
Oh, but then it refines itself in the fall.
New host, and that, right. So in the fall, it kind of selects something that works real well and possibly grows to at a faster rate, and therefore it's got a high viral load when you get infected with that version, or it grows quicker once the infection starts. Having those characteristics give it an advantage, and then you see that type of virus emerge. And
there's so much information,
and that's why there's a lot of research on it. Go ahead.
Well, this aspect of the clotting factor, if I could get back to that, does it explain some of the other phenomena like the COVID toes? We talked about perhaps it explains the strokes. I imagine that this information is affecting how these various phenomena are looked at. And also, there's talk about gut gas transmission. I remember that the Chinese were talking about that in January, but now we're seeing warnings about that mode of transmission. And Stephen Colbert made the joke that we should all now fart into our elbows. So what do you know about this vector? Doesn't that make public bathrooms particularly dangerous?
It could. I mean, the virus has been isolated from stool samples now. So it definitely moves around. I think that's related to this polybasic cleavage site. So it allows it to go into different cell types and go to different locations in the body. And so it definitely shows up there. You know, some patients do have diarrhea. France just published a study that they could see the virus coming by looking at wastewater that it starts showing up in the wastewater at higher levels before it becomes obvious that it's in the population due to people showing up in the hospitals, that it shows up in the bathrooms first and goes into the sewer, and you can pick up the virus there. So it definitely is not just an upper respiratory tract virus. It does kind of move around. I mean, that was one of the characteristics actually of avian influenza, is that the virus, the high path version, was able to show up in the the cloacal swabs.
It finds these reservoirs or these lacunae in the body somehow. I read something about it showing up in the eyes.
Well, viruses typically do cause conjunctivitis, so that's not that unusual. I'm not sure how this compares to some of the other ones, but conjunctivitis is one of the common symptoms of a number of different viruses, including influenza. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see SARS-CoV also show up in those ocular spaces also. It's a virus that seems to get around pretty effectively, and that's one of the reasons there's so much concern, is it seems to be able to cause a number of different problems in kidneys and liver, and these issues with the clotting is the brain and the heart. And so that's part of the problem. A lot of these things are very sudden, so the patient seems to be doing okay, and then all of a sudden they have some type of major issue. I know that the Solomon were the clots were so widespread that they were clogging up the machines, that the patients were on, because they were just filling up with blood clots that were blocking the tubes, and so you couldn't do it was like an ECMO machine that takes the blood out and oxygenates it and puts it back in. The blood was
I wanted to ask you about those ECMO machines. I don't think they're being used. I mean, this is just an impression. I didn't see any numbers, but I got the impression that the Chinese were using the ECMO machines more consistently than the Americans are. Is that the case?
Yeah. Like you say, I haven't really seen that much discussion of it. I've seen a few of the clinical trials. They did talk about some patients on ECMO machines, but it didn't sound like most of them were.
And that's what we used to call a lung machine.
Yeah, and I seem to remember it was SARS that they seemed to have a lot of patients on ECMO machines. So I'm not sure why there seems to be more usage of ventilators than ECMO machines. But I think they are used. They're just not as common. A lot of times they're in short supply, and it could just be the volume is such that they have a lot more ventilators than ECMO machines, and therefore they end up using those more because they have so many patients that need some type of oxygen, and they don't have enough ECMO machines to really do that, so they try to make the ventilators the go-to type of treatment.
Do you think the clotting has affected the survival rate on respirators? Do you think that is there a connection there between someone very passively, being drugged and being put on a ventilator? If that clotting is going on, does that make that worse?
Yeah, I'm not sure why. I mean, the frequency, I had heard was in the neighborhood of 86% never get off the ventilator. Once they go on the ventilator, they're usually not in good shape. And it seemed to me that the ones that die on the ventilators don't do so quickly. It takes a while. And the clots, I think a lot of the ones that die from the clots actually die on the way to the hospital or before they even get to the hospital. I know that what indicated that there was a serious undercount in New York, that when things were at its peak, I think the number of heart attack calls they were getting was close to 200 a day or so, and typically it's 20 a day. So it was this huge spike in the number of calls they got for heart attacks, and then the outcomes were not as good. That typically 30% of the heart attack cases die, and that might be, you know, before they get to the hospital. I'm not sure exactly what the 30% refers to, but the rate is like 70% during these spikes, so that they do have these issues, and it's more serious, and there are a lot of them, and so it raises the possibility that a lot of these cases never even get to the hospital. And and in China, there were films of people literally, you know, falling over on the street, you know, that security cameras, I guess, were getting a lot of these films, and so people are just standing and just kind of fell over, and I think a lot of those were related to these heart attacks, and that also related to a somewhat of an undercount in China, and that might be related to, you know, how many urns were being used relative to how many were being reported as death, because I don't think that the those heart attack cases were necessarily then tested for COVID, and the same thing happened in the U.S. And apparently it seemed to be pretty widespread. I think the New York Times published an article on cases worldwide, and maybe more in Europe, where they looked at the baseline level of fatalities, and they saw these spikes when SARS came, and these were people that weren't being identified as SARS cases, and they weren't being COVID cases, and they ended up just being listed as heart attack cases. But because of when the spikes happened relative to when the COVID outbreaks happened, they concluded that these were almost certainly COVID cases that were dying before they ever got to the hospital.
Is it still considered to be true that that patient one was in December in China, or is there information that the virus may have been around earlier than that?
I think the earliest case was like December 1st, which was quite a bit, which was a couple of weeks before that wet market. And so that's part of the evidence indicating it was circulating in China prior to that. And then there was some speculation that I think that might have been the date of death, and therefore that person would have been infected sometime in November. And consequently, you know, there's speculation that it started, you know, sometime in November. It could have been as early as the beginning of November. You know, but the first case was not affiliated with the wet market, and a reasonable percentage of the initial cases, I think it might have been 14 out of 40 or something, did not have any direct connections to that wet market. And so it does sound like it happened before that. As you know, the U.S. is trying to investigate whether it was some type of lab accident, and potentially if a researcher got infected or tracked the virus out somehow, and that led to the outbreak. There is some evidence pointing in that direction, and that comes from the sequence data. One of the labs in Wuhan had been involved with isolating at the time was the closest version to this particular strain, and that one had been from a bat that had been isolated in 2013, and it was by a lab that was at Wuhan. So they were doing bat research on, you know, SARS-like viruses. But just earlier this week, another lab released two sequences that were both of these were from Yunnan province in China, which kind of borders Cambodia. It's in southern China, not close to Wuhan, or this other lab was in Shandong province, which is even further north. And they had been doing research on bats, and they were at a slightly different location, actually closer to the border with Cambodia. And their version, all of these are horseshoe bats, and this one happened to be a Malaysian horseshoe bat, which is mostly in Southeast Asia. And it was even closer. It was like 97% identical. The other one was 96%. And the other one that they released was close to the original SARS virus. So they had two different isolates, both from this Malaysian version of the horseshoe bat, both from, I think, the same cave even. And it indicates that at least what's known, that the viruses that are closest to this one are further south. They're not in the Wuhan area or further north. They're really in this Yunnan region, which is in the southern part of China. And so if that's really where it's limited, then that would, you know, provide some evidence that potentially the virus got up to Wuhan because it was collected
when you say it was selected, you're referring to evolutionary pressures, process of virus evolution, I take it.
Well, just where is circulating bats have been the subject of a lot of research, but I suppose there's still a lot of bats out there that haven't been sampled. But it turns out that the sequence that's closest to the one that jump species seems to be located in southern China. And the easiest way for that version of the virus to get from southern China to Wuhan would probably be a lab doing research that collected samples down in southern China and brought them back for study in northern China. So that would give you some indirect evidence that possibly the virus in Wuhan, you know, was from elsewhere and was brought there for study. It's unlikely that it was. I mean, there's rumors that it's a bioweapon. Doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, the first requirement of a bioweapon is that you can control it. So to make a bioweapon out of a coronavirus is, you know, you would always have the risk of what actually happened. The virus would get in the human population and it would, you know, spread out of control and you would have no control over it. But another speculation was that maybe they were making a vaccine, but that's also unlikely because this virus, even though it's related to the SARS virus, had never been shown to be in people. And to make a vaccine against a target that hadn't been in people, I mean, they didn't even make vaccines against the SARS virus because it kind of disappeared. So making a vaccine against a virus that had only been found in bats and anteaters is not a logical candidate for a vaccine either. But it could have been brought there just to study the mechanism of the virus and then somehow accidentally got out. And so that can't be excluded because especially if it was an accident, it was on somebody's shoe or something, you know, it may not have, you know, they might not have any record of it even being in the lab if it this was a contaminant, and they didn't isolate a virus that, that matched. So that was just a possibility, but the sequence seems to be more like the virus in bats in southern China than in the Wuhan area or northern China, where there's some research that goes on with these bats and these bat viruses. And for some reason, they
watch on KBOO Portland. I'm talking to Dr. Henry Nyman, internationally known virologist. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. So please go on. You were saying.
So I was just saying that for whatever reason, that it seems to be a popular spot for researchers in China to go down to these caves where the bats are down in Yunnan province. And there are a couple different locations in Yunnan province with different caves that have these bats, but that seems to be a popular place to get samples. And I don't know how widespread the virus is in bats in, you know, like Hubei province or closer to where the outbreak began. And so that would be one way to explain how a virus that's normally found in southern China or in the Malaysian, you know, Southeast Asia. I mean, this species was is actually called, I don't know a scientific name, but it translates into Malaysian horseshoe bat. And that's because its location is usually in, you know, Malaysia, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. It's generally in Southeast Asia. And this spills over just across the border to get into Yunnan province, which is adjacent to Southeast Asia. So that was just one piece on the origin. Whatever the origin, it's definitely out and about, and it's literally a pandemic and is everywhere in the world now. And so it's definitely a concern. And the fact that it was able to spread worldwide like it is another piece of evidence why coronaviruses are an unlikely bioweapon. But that doesn't stop rumors on the internet.
It's difficult. You seem to be implying that it's difficult to make a vaccine with this type of virus. Is that difficult to test?
No. I wouldn't say it's difficult to make a vaccine. In fact, vaccines were made against the SARS virus, but they didn't really go through clinical trials because the SARS virus kind of disappeared. So there really wasn't a market for the vaccine when the vaccines were made. Now, I know here in Pittsburgh at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, they actually do have a vaccine candidate that they're starting on trials. And the reason they came up with a candidate as quickly as they did is they did work on making vaccines both for SARS and MERS. So they already had the vehicle, and all they had to do is just change the sequence that went into it. So instead of using a SARS or MERS sequence, they used a SARS-CoV-2 sequence. You know,
that's good news.
And so they were able to get that started quicker. So that was one of the benefits, because SARS did lead to a lot of research, and it actually led to the discovery of a couple additional coronaviruses that do cause disease in humans, although they're usually in children, and they're generally fairly mild. And one was by a group in the Netherlands, and it's called NL for Netherlands 63, and the other one was in Hong Kong, and it's called HKU for Hong Kong University number one. And so those two versions of coronaviruses were not known to be in humans prior to the outbreak of SARS and the discovery of these. And these, I think, were both discovered by looking in bats. You know, essentially they had the SARS sequence and they had a couple other coronaviruses and picked a region that was highly conserved. And so it's kind of like a pan coronavirus sequence. And they would take samples from the bats and identify various coronaviruses. And then in these two cases, they were able to look at at human respiratory disease patients and identify these two viruses that were basically unknown before SARS, but they're fairly benign, and the same research led to the discovery of MERS. I mean, MERS was discovered the same way. It was looking at bats, and at least to work on its origin, and end up zeroing in on camels as being the reservoir that was responsible for the MERS outbreak, which was mostly in the Middle East, which is essentially what the name stands for, because that's where it was identified. But as far as this virus is concerned, I mean, the big concern is that it isn't, it doesn't seem to be disappearing. I mean, it might be a little bit early, and it might fade dramatically in the next month or so. But in the U.S., worldwide, but in the U.S., which has more than any other place, the numbers are still quite high. I mean, this week it should get to the 50,000th death, so there'll be 50,000 that died by the end of this week.
It's such a shock. It's hard to even deal with that kind of number.
60,000 by next week, right? And it's still going up at over 2,000 deaths a day still at this date. So it's not like it's gone away or even has gone down that much. Because, like I said, even though New York has gone down, other states like New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts have gone up, and they've kind of made up for the shortfall in New York. So the number of deaths is still in the 2,000 a day range, and it's not going up at an exponential rate anymore, but it's steadily going, it's being maintained. So it's steadily producing 2,000 deaths, which is kind of a trailing indicator, but it's also producing around 25,000 new cases each day. So that's why I say it'll hit 900,000 cases probably this week, and it'll probably hit 1 million cases sometime next week. So the numbers are there's clearly a lot of virus floating around, and that's why I say it's very likely that it will kind of come back even stronger in the fall, because it's not like it disappeared. With SARS, it was much lower. I mean, there were 770 deaths or so in the entire outbreak in the entire world. And, that happens kind of on a daily basis.
Do you have an opinion about hydroxychloroquine?
Well, there was a recent trial at the VA that actually wasn't very good at all. There was a higher death rate in the ones that were treated with the hydroxychloroquine than those that got standard care. So that was a relatively big study. There was about 350 cases. So I mean, the concern is that it causes problems with the heart as a side effect, and so using it to prevent malaria in healthy adults versus giving it to patients with acute viral infections that can affect the heart is not necessarily going to work out well with a drug that has heart fibrillation side effects. And so that initial study is not out yet, but the numbers indicated that the death rate was about twice as high for those that got the drug than those that didn't. So that's not a real positive result. And the recommendation is is really not to use it until there's, you know, the clinical trials in and there's evidence of efficacy and not harm, you know. So it doesn't look that good now, you know, at this stage. Whether it could have a prophylactic, you know, a prophylactic type of application. It's hard to do those types of studies. You need a lot of patients.
If it did work,
because,
how would it work? What is its function?
It's what?
How would it work if it did work against the virus? Does it prevent the cytokine storm?
No, it's supposed to work more with the on the heme and the heme and hemoglobin, I think, and how it's held and released, and it has something to do with the mechanism for how it's preventing malaria. It's again not my area, so I can't give you that much more specific.
Okay.
But I think it has to do with the heme molecule. It's how it's supposed to work, and the issue I think is the potential side effects that are cardiac related, and the virus seems to cause, you know, issues with the heart beyond just the clotting. There seems to be irregular heartbeats that are associated with the virus and are associated with the drug, and so, you know, it's not necessarily it's going to cause those side effects in everybody, but it's going to cause them in enough patients, and they may be more susceptible to having a more adverse effect from that type of a side effect than somebody that's you know, relatively healthy and trying to avoid malaria, or someone who's using it for arthritis. Although its treatment for arthritis is an older application, I actually took that drug, you know, 10 years ago or so for arthritis, and it really didn't do anything. And you had to fail on that drug before you go to there's Humira. It's one of the treatments, but it was a lot more expensive, and it's a monoclonal antibody, and the insurance required you fail from the more conventional, much cheaper drugs before they would approve moving on to the
it was
a new treatment.
That brings up another analog to 1918, the usage of ZPAC. Is it zithromycin? Is that what that is? But in any event, an antibiotic anticipating a follow-on infection, I guess, with pneumococcus, and I guess that was part of the sort of the secondary pneumonia in 1918.
Right.
Is that
right?
Do you think
right.
That's effective now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of there's a vaccine for pneumonia. A lot of people have that. Older people, anyway, have got the pneumonia vaccine, and therefore it may not be as big a problem as it was back in 1918. And I don't know if it's you know, how useful it is early before you actually get that infection, that you might be able to treat that infection fairly effectively. Again, this is out of my area, so I'm not sure on whether an earlier treatment with that is recommended. But the outcome, at least on this VA study, it sounded like it was not really showing efficacy, and it was, and they were using the combination, so they were using the antibiotic with the hydroxychloroquine, and that's what the protocol was, but I would assume it's that the hydroxychloroquine which was causing the problems, and it was heart related, but the specifics aren't out yet. It was just that bottom line that the fatality rate was twice as high with the drug than without it.
I see. Well, we are at the top of the hour now, so if you have concluding thoughts, this would be the time for that.
Well, I think the concluding thoughts are that the virus is difficult. It causes a lot of different problems with that clinicians don't have a whole lot of experience with this drug. With this virus. So exactly how well it's going to be managed is still up in the air. And because the virus is hung around as long as it has, it seems very likely that it will be back with a vengeance in the fall. And that's a major concern. And right now is still a difficult situation with the lockdowns on the effect it's having on the economy versus the effect it's having on the virus. And it flattens the curve, which keeps it from overwhelming the hospitals, but it doesn't really eliminate the virus, and it kind of extends the time period that the virus is going to be around. So that seems to be what's happening, and therefore I don't expect the virus to disappear over the summer, and I do expect it to be back in the fall.
Well, I'm very pleased and thankful that you were able to take time out of your schedule, which I know has gotten more and more busy simply because of the nature of your work, and I'm glad that you could join us. You've been listening to Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD, founder of Recombinomics Incorporated, and well known around the world as a virologist and researcher. And this is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Press Watch on KVOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM in the Portland area, other frequencies elsewhere, and via KVOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Thank you very much, Teresa. Thank you all for listening to Press Watch. You are listening to your community connection, KVOO Portland.